This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
With gas prices soaring, President Biden coordinates a response with other countries. The plan? Flood the market with extra oil.
Really won't make much of a difference in terms of the price of oil beyond the market perception of it, which will last maybe a few days.
Also today, Afghanistan's first woman commercial pilot knows the wonders of being in the air.
All the earth problems, they looked so small that I was just enjoying my existence and the joy of flying.
Now Mohaddiseh Mirzai is in exile, but still focused on flying. I'm Marco Werman, and the Beatles not only shaped the sound of rock in Argentina, they shaped Argentina.
They provide a great service to humankind, not only by giving us fantastic music, but also in a way by leading us through these changes.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us. Been to the pump lately? Well, today President Biden announced a scheme to lower gas prices. The plan? Release some of the oil from America's Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We're talking about crude oil stored by the government, an emergency supply, if you will. Speaking from Washington this afternoon, Biden said he's also brought together other nations like the UK, South Korea, Japan, India, and China to coordinate a release of their reserves.
I've worked hard these past few weeks and calls and meetings with foreign leaders, policymakers, to put together the building blocks for today's global announcement. And while our combined actions will not solve the problem of high gas prices overnight, it will make a difference. It will take time, but before long, you should see the price of gas drop where you fill up your tank.
Ellen Wald is following all of this. She's the author of Saudi Inc. First, the basics, Ellen. What is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? How much oil does it contain? And why do we even have it?
The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is something that was created after the 1973 oil shocks, and it's designed to contain 90 days' worth of the supply of oil that is consumed in the United States.
So since 1973, have there been White Houses who use the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to bring down oil prices?
The SPR is designed to be a stopgap if there's ever a disruption in supply, maybe a oil embargo, which is what we saw in 1973, 1974, or it could be, say, a war like we saw during the Gulf War. It can also be due to a natural disaster. We did see the United States release oil from the SPR in response to Hurricane Katrina. For example, it has been used in the past to try to lower gasoline prices, although that's not really the intention of the SPR.
How much oil is President Biden talking about actually releasing, and what percentage is that amount of the total reserve?
So he's talking about releasing 50 million barrels, which is what we would consume in the United States in 2.5 days. The reserve itself is much larger, about 727 million barrels. So we're talking about a fairly small percentage of the total reserve.
So this is in coordination with other countries. We saw a list that includes the UK, South Korea, and Japan, and also India and China. What are they going to do?
India is preparing to release about, I think, 4.5 million barrels, which is equivalent to about a day's worth of consumption. The UK, they're saying that companies can choose to release from their stores up to 1.5 million if they want to. So it's not even clear if the UK is actually going to release that amount. We've heard from Japan that they are going to be releasing several days worth of oil from their strategic reserve. And we really haven't heard yet from China or Korea.
So the 50 million barrels released by the U.S., I mean, as you said, that'll be the equivalent of U.S. consumption of energy across 2 days. What difference will that actually make, even if all those other countries pony up a proportional amount for their population?
We definitely see some impact to gasoline prices, but we're really looking at transient effects, so very short term. And in fact, oil prices were already starting to come down on news that there were going to be more coronavirus lockdowns in Europe.
So, Ellen, what's the point of all this?
For some reason, in the United States, people tend to blame high gasoline prices on whatever administration is in power, regardless of whether they have any role in the high gasoline prices to begin with. And so there's a lot of pressure on the Biden administration to do something.
Well, in the 1970s, when gas prices went up and the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was created, I got to remember Jimmy Carter told us to wear a sweater, turn down our heat. What do you make of this push to release and use gas and oil right after COP26 and the dire warnings about radically drawing down fossil fuel use?
Well, this is definitely an issue because we're seeing a case of saying one thing and doing another. And I think that this is emblematic of the fact that we are still heavily reliant on fossil fuels, natural gas, oil, coal even. And while we definitely want to move forward with this energy transition to greener, more renewable sources of power, we're just not there.
Ellen Wald is the author of Saudi Inc., speaking with us about the White House plan to release oil from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Ellen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Releasing more oil may help ease prices at the pump, but as we know, there are environmental consequences to burning more fossil fuels. Battling climate change grabs the lion's share of environmental headlines these days. Here's another challenge we don't hear about as much: overfishing. Simply put, for decades, we've been removing fish faster from the seas and lakes than they can replenish. Yet governments around the world, including the U.S., not only allow overfishing, they actually pay fishing boats to turn parts of the ocean into so-called dead zones. The World Trade Organization will soon discuss banning this practice. Meanwhile, a well-known marine biologist, Daniel Pauly, who teaches at the University of British Columbia, says our seas are reaching a tipping point. The World's Patrick Wynn spoke with Pauly. Here's part of their conversation.
Dr. Pauly, when we talk about overfishing, that mostly means a type of fishing called trawler fishing. How does it work?
Trawling is dragging a net behind a powerful boat. And the dimension of the nets is such that you could put four jumbo jets at the same time in it. Four jumbo jets. So these nets, they are dragged on the bottom of the ocean. And they everything that is in their path, they take. This is very different from catching fish with hook and lines.
Right, so it's really imprecise.
Yep, the big fish, the small fish, the medium fish of different species, they all get caught. And then what they do usually, you reject all the fish that you don't want. So millions of tons of fish, perfectly good fish, is thrown overboard by trawlers all over the world. It can be so extreme as rejecting 90% of your catch, dead, obviously dead into the water. This is an extremely wasteful method of fishing.
Your research has shown that trawling creates these dead zones in the ocean with mostly just jellyfish floating around. So what does that mean for trawlers who are still out there trying to scoop up fish?
What it means is that the trawler fleets have to go further and further, and they don't catch much. So what do? You beg your government for subsidies, lower costs on capital, you get lower costs on fuel, you get lower costs on building and repair, loans and so on. All of these subsidies amount to about a third of the value of the catch.
So following that logic, as we drain the oceans of fish, the trawlers have to get more aggressive, burn more fuel, ask the government for more assistance just to collect the fish that are left. Is that right?
Yes. Scientists, fishery scientists, are trying desperately to remove subsidies from big fleets, from big trawlers, because they are not needed to produce the fish that we want. They are not needed. This is a race to the bottom, which is completely useless. It's like global warming. We could do without things that are causing all this problem. And there are lobbies that prevent us from doing so.
Around the world, all the countries put together are giving $35 billion a year in subsidies to trawlers. It's a lot of money. I see 700 million of that is coming from the U.S. How big a factor is the U.S. here?
The U.S. is not the major subsidizer. The major subsidizers are China, Spain, and France, and Italy. And in Asia, it is China, Japan, Korea. And these subsidies enable fleet to be kept afloat that don't really earn a net profit.
If you took away government money, would the trawler fleets go out of business?
Yes, they would go bust right away. Right now, the WTO is negotiating about the abolition of subsidies. They will probably not succeed, but if they did, it would have no negative effect on food supply. And in the case of trawlers, getting rid of them would enable the other sectors of fisheries, especially smaller boats, smaller players that don't use so much energy and that don't get subsidies so much.
Dr. Pauly, these dead zones in the ocean keep growing and growing and growing. Do you worry that it's too late to reverse this trend?
It's never too late. What would it mean? We give them more subsidies, they can destroy more? Doesn't make sense. It is always a good thing to do what is right.
That was marine biologist Daniel Pauly speaking with the world's Patrick Wynn about the problem of overfishing the world's oceans. If only you knew the humble beginnings of E equals MC squared. Oh, they know at Christie's Auction House in Paris, where the century-old scribblings of Albert Einstein fetched a healthy price today. A rare 54-page manuscript written by Einstein and his close friend Michele Besso, an Italian engineer. The pages reveal a critical stage in the development of the general theory of relativity. To talk about that is Lee Smolin, a theoretical physicist and direct intellectual descendant of Einstein at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. Professor Smolin, all you got to do is look at the Christie's auction catalog and anyone can see these images. For you, though, a physicist, what's it like to look at these 108-year-old jottings of Albert Einstein?
What's amazing, if you are a theoretical physicist and you have a chance to look through these notebooks of Einstein, is how contemporary they are. He used really the same bag of tricks and tools that we do. I can easily recognize what he's doing and why he's doing it. I don't read German, but it hardly matters. The mathematics is very clear. And, of course, Einstein was really good at this, and it's wonderful to track his progress. But what's behind it is even more important and more interesting. Einstein changed his mind as he worked on the theory of general relativity. He hasn't yet invented general relativity, so he's using special relativity, and he gets the wrong answer. That is, the answer disagrees with experiment. What happened later in 1915 is he invented the right theory and then quickly redid this calculation and found that the right theory now, general relativity, agreed with the experiments, with the observations.
That's kind of the theoretical background. I mean, looking just at the documents, I mean, it's kind of impressive, Einstein's penmanship. His equations and notes are really neat. Was that typical of the time, or is that typical of Einstein?
I think both. And here again, Einstein is such a figure to us that having the relic, which has his handwriting and his splotches and so forth, somebody is willing to pay somebody a fortune for. And I'm sure this is what Einstein would have said about this. He would have said, such nonsense, who cares? The important thing is the thoughts. And it doesn't matter whose handwriting they're in or what the value of the manuscript is. That change of mind is one of the most significant changes of mind to happen in the whole history of science. And he knew that. He knew what was at stake.
Absolutely fascinating, and absolutely sold for $11.4 million at Christie's Auction House in Paris. That was Lee Smolin of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Ontario, Canada, speaking with me earlier today about a rare manuscript of Albert Einstein's from 1913. What progress could we make with a little cooperation? Leaders in public health are asking that question as they consider a global agreement on how to deal with pandemics. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For 26 years now, world leaders have been meeting annually to tackle the planet's climate crisis, most recently, as you know, in Glasgow at the UN's climate summit. Progress has been slow. Next week, representatives from around the globe will convene to address another grave threat: future pandemics. It's not nearly as hyped as those climate talks, but as the world's Alana Gordon reports, the goals are just as ambitious and perhaps even more challenging.
Getting countries to agree on how to prevent diseases may be hard, but it's not new.
This idea that we need legal rules to protect ourselves and each other from epidemics is an old idea.
Gianluca Burci is a former lawyer for the World Health Organization in Geneva. He says over 100 years ago, a different infectious disease prompted similar debates to what we're having today.
Cholera, for example, swept through Europe multiple times and devastated countries like the UK and so on. And cholera was endemic in India and came basically through movement of people, means of transport, and goods.
Countries developed protocols for how ships could safely go from one port to the next, what quarantining should involve. We didn't really understand how diseases worked then, so the efforts largely failed. Countries also violated international rules when it suited their own economic needs.
One thing that to me has not changed from 1850s to now is the chronic inability to be ahead of the game. The pathogens, the bugs are always ahead of the game. So we are trying to close the gap.
This need led to the creation of the World Health Organization after World War II, and then a consensus on those health rules. They've been revised over the years, but they're not enforceable. Today's pandemic has paralyzed the entire world and killed millions. It's a new wake-up call.
We cannot do things the way we have done them before and expect a different result.
WHO's Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus, speaking earlier this year.
We must act boldly.
The situation has prompted a very rare special session of the WHO this coming Monday. Very rare. It's only happened once before. Member states will determine whether to develop an entirely new legal framework. And specifically, momentum is building for a pandemic treaty of sorts. The European Union has been leading the drive. Here's Charles Michel, president of the European Council, earlier this year.
Through this treaty, our main goal is to foster a comprehensive approach to better predict, prevent, and respond to pandemics.
At least 24 countries backed Michel right at the onset. But not everyone has jumped on board, including the United States. Rebecca Katz is an expert in global health security at Georgetown University, and until recently, a senior advisor at the U.S. State Department. She worries that creating something entirely new could distract from improving global health rules that countries have already signed on to.
The U.S. position has been that, you know, it's not against a new agreement, but you first start with the agreements you have and figure out how you fix them. And I think there is also a little bit of realism here.
A treaty could take years for all countries to get behind and risks becoming really watered down.
The challenge here is that you're looking at something that is about mitigating the impact of a virus, but also has to address issues of travel and trade, that also has to touch upon issues of intellectual property rights, which also has to touch upon the international security, regional security, national security implications of all these decisions.
The pandemic has exposed weaknesses in all countries. It's created bigger divisions and deeper inequities. The current system doesn't address access to resources like vaccines. Many want that front and center in these upcoming talks. Gianluca Burci, the former lawyer for the WHO, says countries have to start somewhere.
Politically, it can potentially be a big deal, but the big deal will mature in time.
Many say next week will be a defining moment, and that the time is now, in this tragedy, to try to do something big. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Immigration reform advocates are still waiting for President Biden to fulfill many of his campaign promises, among them minimizing the time undocumented immigrants spend in detention centers. For that, the government is turning to alternatives, but these can be controversial. The World's Daisy Contreras has more.
Kadeem Golding left an immigration detention center in Alabama 6 months ago.
It wasn't my choice to come to this country at a young age. It wasn't my choice not to have proper documentation throughout the course of my life.
Golding, who's 36 and originally from Jamaica, came to the U.S. when he was 9. In his 20s, he served 10 years in prison. But just as he was being released, immigration officials took him into their custody. He was transferred to a federal detention center where he faced deportation. This is routine.
They used what they deemed my matter of entry, or there's no proof of entry, but I've been in this country for pretty much 27 years.
Golding spent 5 years in detention fighting deportation. Now he lives with his family in New York City. But ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is still tracking his movements. Golding wears a bulky black GPS-enabled ankle monitor.
It's definitely a false sense of freedom. For me, it's just a bigger cell. I just have a bigger cell or a bigger jail that I'm in.
Golding is not the only one wearing one of these monitors. About 136,000 immigrants are being tracked this way today, either by ankle bracelets or a phone tracker. These tools are considered alternatives to detention, cheaper than holding people inside a detention facility, federal officials say. And under the Biden administration, these monitors are being used at a record rate. But some immigrant rights advocates say that while they keep immigrants out of jail-like settings, they are not solutions.
They don't provide alternatives to people who are currently detained. They just bring new people into the enforcement system.
Sitare Gandhihari is with Detention Watch Network, a national organization working to end immigration detention.
And so really what it's doing is increasing the net of people who could end up under surveillance or in detention.
Immigration officials say tracking immigrants outside of the walls of a detention center is necessary to make sure that people show up for their court hearings. Serene Shabaya doesn't agree. She's a civil rights lawyer who runs the National Immigration Project, a nationwide network of immigration lawyers.
I don't think it's ethical to monitor human bodies in this way. I don't think it's ethical to pay companies a large amount of money to put an ankle bracelet on someone who really just needs to be in their communities and with their families and pursuing jobs and doing the normal things that we are all able to do with our lives.
Plus, she says, people who are monitored develop health problems. Some get burns from their ankle monitors. Many feel like they never left detention and have constant anxiety. That's because monitors have to be worn and charged at all times, even in the shower. Kadeem Golding, the immigrant from Jamaica, says his mental health has suffered because of the monitor. He says he wakes up in the middle of the night to charge his, fearing it'll turn off. He also doesn't know how long he'll need to wear the device, or if ICE will have him use another form of surveillance, like a phone tracking app. And there's something else he finds difficult. The summer months, when he wants to wear shorts, his ankle monitor shows. It's stigmatizing, he says.
People are just staring. So if they don't know your story, it's like, well, hey, you know, you have to deal with that.
It makes him especially uncomfortable when he picks up his stepdaughter from school. The other kids and parents ask if he's in a gang. Sometimes he stays quiet because it's too much to explain. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For 26 years now, world leaders have been meeting annually to tackle the planet's climate crisis, most recently, as you know, in Glasgow at the UN's climate summit. Progress has been slow. Next week, representatives from around the globe will convene to address another grave threat, future pandemics. It's not nearly as hyped as those climate talks, but as the world's Alana Gordon reports, the goals are just as ambitious and perhaps even more challenging.
Getting countries to agree on how to prevent diseases may be hard, but it's not new.
This idea that we need legal rules to protect ourselves and each other from epidemics is an old idea.
Gianluca Burci is a former lawyer for the World Health Organization in Geneva. He says over 100 years ago, a different infectious disease prompted similar debates to what we're having today.
Cholera, for example, swept through Europe multiple times and devastated countries like the UK and so on. And cholera was endemic in India and came basically through movement of people, means of transport, and goods.
Countries developed protocols for how ships could safely go from one port to the next, what quarantining should involve. We didn't really understand how diseases worked then, so the efforts largely failed. Countries also violated international rules when it suited their own economic needs.
One thing that to me has not changed from 1850s to now is the chronic inability to be ahead of the game. The pathogens, the bugs are always ahead of the game. So we are trying to close the gap.
This need led to the creation of the World Health Organization after World War II, and then a consensus on those health rules. They've been revised over the years, but they're not enforceable. Today's pandemic has paralyzed the entire world and killed millions. It's a new wake-up call.
We cannot do things the way we have done them before and expect a different result.
WHO's Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus speaking earlier this year.
We must act boldly.
The situation has prompted a very rare special session of the WHO this coming Monday. Very rare. It's only happened once before. Member states will determine whether to develop an entirely new legal framework. And specifically, momentum is building for a pandemic treaty of sorts. The European Union has been leading the drive. Here's Charles Michel, president of the European Council, earlier this year.
Through this treaty, our main goal is to foster a comprehensive approach to better predict, prevent, and respond to pandemics.
At least two dozen countries backed Michel right at the onset. But not everyone has jumped on board, including the United States. Rebecca Katz is an expert in global health security at Georgetown University, and until recently, a senior advisor at the U.S. State Department. She worries that creating something entirely new could distract from improving global health rules that countries have already signed on to.
The U.S. position has been that, you know, it's not against a new agreement, but you first start with the agreements you have and figure out how you fix them. And I think there is also a little bit of realism here.
A treaty could take years for all countries to get behind and risks becoming really watered down.
The challenge here is that you're looking at something that is about mitigating the impact of a virus, but also has to address issues of travel and trade, that also has to touch upon issues of intellectual property rights, which also has to touch upon the international security, regional security, national security implications of all these decisions.
The pandemic has exposed weaknesses in all countries. It's created bigger divisions and deeper inequities. The current system doesn't address access to resources like vaccines. Many want that front and center in these upcoming talks. Gianluca Burchi, the former lawyer for the WHO, says countries have to start somewhere.
Politically, it can potentially be a big deal, but the big deal will mature in time.
Many say next week will be a defining moment and that the time is now, in this tragedy, to try to do something big. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
Immigration reform advocates are still waiting for President Biden to fulfill many of his campaign promises, among them minimizing the time undocumented immigrants spend in detention centers. For that, the government is turning to alternatives, but these can be controversial. The world's Daisy Contreras has more.
Kadeem Golding left an immigration detention center in Alabama 6 months ago.
It wasn't my choice to come to this country at a young age. It wasn't my choice not to have proper documentation throughout the course of my life.
Golding, who's 36 and originally from Jamaica, came to the U.S. when he was 9. In his 20s, he served 10 years in prison. But just as he was being released, immigration officials took him into their custody. He was transferred to a federal detention center where he faced deportation. This is routine.
They used what they deemed my matter of entry, or there's no proof of entry, but I've been in this country for pretty much 27 years.
Golding spent 5 years in detention fighting deportation. Now he lives with his family in New York City. But ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is still tracking his movements. Golding wears a bulky black GPS-enabled ankle monitor.
It's definitely a false sense of freedom. For me, it's just a bigger cell. I just have a bigger cell or a bigger jail that I'm in.
Golding is not the only one wearing one of these monitors. About 136,000 immigrants are being tracked this way today, either by ankle bracelets or a phone tracker. These tools are considered alternatives to detention, cheaper than holding people inside a detention facility, federal officials say. And under the Biden administration, these monitors are being used at a record rate. But some immigrant rights advocates say that while they keep immigrants out of jail-like settings, they are not solutions.
They don't provide alternatives to people who are currently detained. They just bring new people into the enforcement system.
Sitare Gandhihari is with Detention Watch Network, a national organization working to end immigration detention.
And so really what it's doing is increasing the net of people who could end up under surveillance or in detention.
Immigration officials say tracking immigrants outside of the walls of a detention center is necessary to make sure that people show up for their court hearings. Serene Shabaya doesn't agree. She's a civil rights lawyer who runs the National Immigration Project, a nationwide network of immigration lawyers.
I don't think it's ethical to monitor human bodies in this way. I don't think it's ethical to pay companies a large amount of money to put an ankle bracelet on someone who really just needs to be in their communities and with their families and pursuing jobs and doing the normal things that we are all able to do with our lives.
Plus, she says, people who are monitored develop health problems. Some get burns from their ankle monitors. Many feel like they never left detention and have constant anxiety. That's because monitors have to be worn and charged at all times, even in the shower. Karim Golding, the immigrant from Jamaica, says his mental health has suffered because of the monitor. He says he wakes up in the middle of the night to charge his, fearing it'll turn off. He also doesn't know how long he'll need to wear the device, or if ICE will have him use another form of surveillance, like a phone tracking app. And there's something else he finds difficult. The summer months, when he wants to wear shorts, his ankle monitor shows. It's stigmatizing, he says.
People are just staring. So if they don't know your story, it's like, well, hey, you know, you have to deal with that.
It makes him especially uncomfortable when he picks up his stepdaughter from school. The other kids and parents ask if he's in a gang. Sometimes he stays quiet because it's too much to explain. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're listening to The World. Nearly a billion people across the globe don't have enough to eat. One solution, the community fridge.
The motto that we always come back to is take what you need and leave what you can.
During the pandemic, the shared fridge movement has boomed across the globe. Also ahead, how John Paul, George, and Ringo influenced a generation of Argentine rockers. Still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For about a month now, the border between Belarus and Poland has been an international flashpoint. Thousands of migrants have arrived there, desperate to cross into the European Union. The EU accuses Belarus of orchestrating the chaos, intentionally directing thousands of asylum seekers to that border. Poland has responded by amassing troops at the entry points and sending the migrants back. But as Andrew Connolly reports from eastern Poland, an underground network of locals is trying to help desperate people who are now stranded in the forest.
The Polish border is sealed. The Belarusian authorities told you lies. Go back to Minsk. So reads the text message sent by the Polish government to all foreign registered phones as soon as you approach the country's eastern border with Belarus. But not all Poland citizens think their government should force migrants back to Belarus. The fire station in the eastern town of Mykolowo has become a distribution point for donations. Shelves are piled high with food, clothes, diapers and medicine. The volunteer firemen give the supplies to migrants they meet in the forest when on patrol. Krzyzek is a burly, mustachioed fireman in his 50s. We don't have a choice, Krzyzek tells me. We're on the front line. We have the space, we have the capacity. We're not so old yet, so we still have the energy. And these people are in a bad situation. The Polish government has demarcated a 3-mile-wide strip of land along the 250-mile-long border and banned all media and humanitarian organizations from entering. But the firemen and other committed locals are determined to help migrants stranded there in freezing temperatures. At least 10 migrants have been found dead on the Belarusian border. Activists fear there are many more. More recently, the youngest victim was a one-year-old child from Syria. Over the weekend, a small demonstration by mothers was held in the nearby town of Hanovka. They chanted, "The forest is not the place for children." Among them, high school teacher Kasia Wapa.
They are on the verge of dying. We saw many people for whom just about a week was enough almost to disappear from this planet.
Rather than large aid agencies, the humanitarian effort on the Belarusian border is largely led by ordinary Poles.
Not long ago, we just had our normal, average lives. We were not activists, we were not nurses, we were not lawyers, we were not psychologists, and suddenly we are all these things in one when we go to the forest and we never know what happens.
On the sidelines, Oliver Kruszek and two friends stand out with their bright orange paramedic uniforms. In the evening, they'll join a patrol to give support to migrants in the forest. Like most people, this isn't what he normally does.
What's his day job normally when he's not doing this?
A jak tutaj nie jesteś, to gdzie pracujesz?
Jestem ogólnie z zawodu kreatorem wizerunku komerskiego. Barbershop.
Really? Tak. Okay, he's a barber.
No i dlaczego jeszcze? Dlatego ogólnie też mnie dziwi sytuacja, która jest na granicy.
I wanted to join because I see the Geneva Convention being violated, Krzysiek tells me, which all citizens of Poland should respect. I'm not saying we should accept everyone, but we have to do something to help. There are children in the forest.
Okay, I'll go back in the choir, sure, so yeah. I'll just follow
you. Follow us, okay?
Only residents living inside the exclusion zone are allowed to enter. I meet one of them at a police checkpoint near her house. She didn't want her name used, though. She has enough problems with the neighbours as it is.
What do most people associate this area for?
Just the nature. Nature and the beautiful forest and the national park and the bisons and then, you know, like deer and wild animals. And that's essentially it.
One night, when helping a group of migrants in the forest, her neighbours called the border guards to take them away.
So they just packed, you know, all of them on a big military truck. There were kids there. There were two little girls. One was maybe 3 years old, the other one maybe 5, 6 years old, sisters. And they were instantly just taken back to the forest with their entire family.
What was that like to watch?
It was horrible. It was heartbreaking. I was just standing there and crying, right?
For her, this ancient forest, the oldest in Europe, will never be the same again.
I can't walk in the forest without looking for people anymore. You know, it's like, I always just look around. It's like, okay, there might be somebody hiding there. There might be somebody who needs help. I'm not leaving my house without a couple of packages of food and water and socks and, you know, most necessary things to survive.
Concentrated into one heart, or two hearts.
In the nearby village of Verestok, Kamil Siller's house looks out on a big stretch of open field in front of the forest where bison roam. There's a pair of binoculars by his window. Siller, a local lawyer, started to put a green light outside his home to signal that migrants would find food, clothes and shelter.
Why did you choose green for the light?
Because red is not so fine. Blue is police, and yellow is normal light.
But soon, Silla realized that his signal of safety was also attracting the attention of the authorities, who are looking for migrants to push back to Belarus. Unwittingly, the light may have become a trap.
Yesterday, I saw the border guard car staying behind the village. They probably were hunting for people who may see this light with the thermovision camera.
Despite the obstacles, in October alone, nearly 2,500 migrants managed to cross Poland and reach Germany. But many more thousands are still waiting to make the deadly journey through the Belarusian border. And a small group of locals will continue to wait for them. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly, Eastern Poland.
Hunger around the world has seen a significant rise over the past few years. The UN reports that more than 900 million people don't have enough to eat. At the same time, it's estimated that 17% of our food gets wasted. There's no single solution here, but a grassroots option has been popping up across the globe. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the impacts of community fridges.
David Rose is one of the volunteers who helps run my local community fridge in Brighton, Massachusetts. He says the concept is simple.
The motto that we always come back to is take what you need and leave what you can.
These fridges are easy to spot. They're usually painted with bright colors, yellow in Rose's case, and they're easy to get to. The Brighton fridge is next to a church, but others are on sidewalks or outside grocery stores. And community members like Rose make sure they're stocked with food for everyone.
It doesn't even need to be for people who are, quote, in need, right? Everybody needs something. Everybody needs to eat.
Rose says that need was heightened in his own community once COVID-19 hit. So he and other organizers launched the fridge in the fall of 2020. Food banks and soup kitchens stepped in to help last year, but Rose says many community fridges distance themselves from traditional charities.
A lot of those organizations are doing a degree of good work, but where I and people that share my opinions think that they fail is those barriers that are in place.
Barriers like only offering food at certain times to people of certain religions or those who speak certain languages.
And so one of the biggest goals of the community fridges is to put this stuff literally on the street. There's no schedule, there's no lock on the door, and there's no restriction on what you take other than take what you need.
In the U.S. alone, over 200 new fridges have opened since March 2020. But the idea long predates the pandemic. The first community fridge debuted in Berlin back in 2012. It was followed by one in Spain and then several throughout the UK. In Egypt, Walid Mahoub picked up the idea in 2017.
We started in Cairo with three fridges.
Mahoub has a full-time job, but calls this work his baby. He says he launched the fridges so people could access food without feeling any of the shame that sometimes surrounds asking for help. It's been a huge success.
Now there are more than 150 fridges across Egypt.
But getting the fridges up and running isn't always easy. Trudy Burrows faced a few challenges when she started planning a fridge just outside of Christchurch, New Zealand, a few years ago.
At first, I actually didn't even know where I was going to get some food from.
The fridges are typically filled with donations from community members or nearby businesses with excess food. Turnover is fast. Items can be in and out on the same day. So Burrows made a deal with a local supermarket to get their surplus goods.
But then a new manager came only a week before I was opening the fridge. And he said, I don't think we can give you anything. So for the first 6 months, it was really difficult.
Burrows says it was also tough finding a location for the fridge. Some business owners had misconceptions about who would be using it. Organizers faced the same issue in Boston. David Rose says at the fridge's first location, the restaurant owners were happy to host the fridge, but the property owners were not.
They decided to unplug the fridge and cut the power to it without telling anybody. We found out this had happened by finding all the food in the fridge spoiled the next day. It was about it being unappealing visually and attracting people that they didn't want in front of their building.
Both Burrows and Rose say their fridges are now well supported with enough electricity and food. When it comes to the type of food, each fridge mirrors the community it serves. In Iceland, you'll find homemade soup. In Cairo, it's juice, water, and baked goods. And in Kelowna, British Columbia, it's fruits and veggies.
It is an area that grows a lot of produce for Western Canada.
Lauren St. Clair helps run the fridge, which launched this past spring. For her, the benefits of the fridge have gone far beyond the food.
We were able to hear folks engaging at the fridge. People would just meet for the first time at the fridge and have these wonderful conversations, and they could be coming from totally different backgrounds.
To start the fridge, St. Clair and her fellow volunteers got a lot of guidance from organizers in other cities. There's actually a global Slack channel called Fridge, where people share tips. St. Clair wants people to know that if they want to start a fridge, an international community is there to help. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Looking for something else to watch besides football on Thursday? I think a lot of people will be checking out the new Beatles documentary, Get Back. The 3-part series rolls out on Disney Plus on Thanksgiving. The films are sure to prompt a lot of nostalgia for John, Paul, George, and Ringo. In Argentina, the Beatles not only influenced several generations of rockers, the Fab Four's impact there went even deeper. The Rose Lucia Benavides has a story about how her country heard and processed the Beatles.
My mom, Ida, was 10 years old when the Beatles first came into her life. It was 1963, and her dad had just bought her the album with the Beatles.
Then we began listening to the records, no, of the Beatles. And that was the beginning of everything.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. The Beatles quickly became the most popular band in Argentina, as they did in many parts of the world.
Well, the Beatles were on TV all the time. I had all my notebooks with photos of the Beatles.
And soon, there were groups from all over Latin America imitating their sound. One of them was Los Shakers, 4 lads from Uruguay who decided to form the band in 1964 after watching the Beatles movie A Hard Day's Night.
We want you to count. They would sing in English. We want you to hear. And they would dress like the Beatles.
We want you to dance, dance all night long.
And they were very good.
But when the music start, don't stand there like a fool and break it off. You listen to me break it all.
Their biggest hit, released in 1966, was called Break It All, and it was proof that good rock music could be made right there on home soil. But Argentine musician Lito Nevia says there was one thing missing, lyrics locals could understand.
Cuando le preguntan, vos sos de los primeros que empezó a cantar en castellano, ¿y en qué íbamos a cantar, en japonés?
He says people often point out his band was one of the first in Argentina to sing in Spanish. For him, it was ridiculous not to sing in their native tongue. In 1967, Nevia and his band Los Gatos released their first single, La Balsa, and it was an overnight sensation. La Balsa became the first rock hit in Argentina sung in Spanish.
Estoy solo y triste acá en este mundo abandonado.
Lyrics explore the urge to escape this sad and abandoned world, to gather enough wood to build una balsa, a raft, and float aimlessly at sea.
Esta idea de los años 60, de que nadie tiene que tener número ni hacer lo mismo.
It's this idea from the 1960s, he says, where you don't have to conform to society. You can live however you want. The success of Los Gatos was followed by the emergence of numerous rock bands. Manal, Almendra, Arcoiris. It ushered in a whole new era of Argentine music. El rock argentino.
Beso mares de algodón, sin mareas, suaves son, sublimándolo.
So it's really a grassroots thing. That's how it grew.
Gustavo Santolalla was the lead singer and guitarist of Arcoiris. Now he's an Oscar-winning producer and composer based in L.A. He says rock argentino has its own particular sound. It often fuses British rock with Latin American folk music. His band was one of the first in Argentina to experiment with this, using traditional rhythms from the Andes Mountains region and instruments like the siku, a type of pan flute.
I didn't want to just write songs, you know, that were kind of like Beatles songs, but in Spanish, you know. I wanted to do something that had an identity.
The birth of rock argentino coincided with a turbulent time in Latin American history when many countries fell under military dictatorships and tens of thousands of supposed political dissidents were tortured and killed. Many of the victims were students, journalists, social workers, and musicians.
We were somehow, you know, persecuted by the government. The only thing I did was having long hair and playing an electric guitar and playing a rock band. I didn't belong to any political party.
rock music was seen as a threat to military rule, and musicians like Santaolalla and Nebbia went into exile. But they continued to write music and speak out against human rights violations through veiled lyrics that were subtle enough to pass censorship laws. Santaolalla says using music to question authority stemmed in part from the Beatles.
They provided great service to humankind, not only by giving us fantastic music, but also in a way by leading us through these changes that were happening in the world.
He says it was a momentous time when music was at the forefront of revolutionary change. For the world, I'm Lucia Benavides.
Mohaddiseh Mirzayi was a true pioneer in Afghanistan, the country's first female commercial airline pilot. Now Mirzayi is in exile in Bulgaria. On the day the Taliban took over Kabul, Mirzayi was at the airport in the city, prepping for an overnight flight to Istanbul. Her plane never took off. Instead, Mirzayi ended up on a different flight to Kiev as a passenger. She has not been back to Afghanistan since. Mohaddiseh Mirzayi joins us now from Sofia, the Bulgarian capital. Mohaddiseh, take us to the day you had to leave Afghanistan. What do you remember?
It was a normal day at first for me. I was wearing my uniform, going to the airport, thinking about I'm just going to have my usual normal flight, going to Istanbul and then come back. But once I was in the airport, I saw that something's unusual. I remember when I was going to pass through the security check and x-ray, there was no one there. When I get closer to the plane, I saw people storming the planes and running, and some of the people, they had guns in their hands, fighting who will get in the airplane. That was a crazy scene I had to see, and I didn't know what's happening.
How did you end up, then, as a passenger on that flight to Kiev?
The thing is, I was flying to Istanbul, but then by the time I was going to get on board that plane, the plane was already full of people. And they were trying to look for any pilot. Doesn't matter if that pilot knows how to fly that plane or any other plane. They were just looking for a pilot to get that plane up in the air. So the only plane that was possible for us, it was away from the other planes, so people couldn't see it properly. It was a special flight to Ukraine. And that was the only option that office told us that we can safely get out if Taliban don't enter the airport before we get airborne.
So that was the day you left Afghanistan, Mohaddiseh. What a drama. What has life been like for you in exile?
I'm going to tell you, I'm glad that I'm safe. But leaving my home behind, leaving family behind, leaving the crew behind, it's very sad for me. Like, I've worked so much to get where I am. And I thought that my country is actually changing. It's evolving. We are fighting for women and people are accepting us. They're taking us as a part of the society. I was actually happy. Like, people were actually welcoming us. They were open to the idea of letting their daughters to come to the aviation and fly with us. So seeing everything quickly and out of nowhere drop to zero is very sad and it's wrong. Like, I don't want to accept that.
I'm speaking with Mohaddiseh Mirzayi, Afghanistan's first female commercial airline pilot. She's now in exile in Bulgaria. So it's been more than a year since you became the first female commercial airline pilot for Afghanistan. How did that journey start for you?
When I decided to become a pilot, officially after high school, I was very serious about it. But I didn't know how to start it. Like, aviation is something, becoming a pilot in Afghanistan is something people don't talk about it very much, and we don't have much information about it. And the funny thing is, I remember I had a meeting with one of the authorities, and he just looked at me and it was like, "You're too small to be flying jet planes."
Wow.
And I was like, well, do I need to be bigger? Like, is it a requirement? They're like, yes. I don't think for such a small body, you can fly a jet. It needs muscles and you don't have it. And I don't know why this idea came to your mind, but drop it. Forget about it.
And clearly that's not the case, is it?
No, of course not. I mean, like, at this age, who needs the muscles? I mean, it's technology. It's the knowledge you need to have. And by the time I finished my high school in Canada, it was very normal idea in Canada. And they were like, yeah, sure, why not? Here's the flight school. They give me guidance. And I start flying in Canada and try to go back to Afghanistan. I showed them my documents. I showed them my flight hours. And I told them that, remember, I came here a few years ago. I told you that I want to become a pilot. It's not just something I said. It's my passion. It's my dream. It's my goal. And I have actually acted upon it.
What was the reaction?
They couldn't believe that I started flying. And they were impressed, but still didn't want to take the risk. I don't know why. Maybe they were afraid, or they still had this belief of stereotype that, oh, it's a male-dominated field and she cannot do it. But once you want something, you have to work hard for it. That's what I did. And finally, Calm Air was very helpful. They helped me, supported me, and I finished my studies in Philippines. I came back to Afghanistan. They were very impressed, very proud. And I felt like I changed the way of thinking of men in Afghanistan. And I think every woman can do it.
Mahadise, talk about the thrill of flying. What was it like for you the first time you flew a plane?
I remember first time when I was flying, my instructor told me that, okay, you have controls, take the plane up in the air. And that was my first lesson. I was like, is he okay? Why is he asking me that? I don't know how to do that. But he was like, just feel relaxed. And he told me how to do it. And of course, he was like backing me up, but I didn't know. When we were in the air, I felt very powerful and I felt my dreams coming true. I felt like all my hard work, all my waiting, all my passion, they all paid off. I could actually do it and prove that they were wrong in Afghanistan. And once you get up there, you look down and it's a place that you don't see any problems. You don't see any discrimination. Like, you're just in the air. You're enjoying the views and you're just thinking about how I can fly this plane, how to get to the destination, how to enjoy. So all the earth problems, they looked so small that I was just enjoying my existence and the joy of flying.
Have you been able to fly a plane since you've left Afghanistan?
Unfortunately, no, not yet.
What does that feel like? Having that ability one day and that career one day and now not?
When I started flying, the sky felt like home. Airport was like my second home. It becomes addictive sometimes, but like in a good addiction. Like you love the feeling when you're flying, when you see you're connecting people together. And not having that anymore, it really broke my heart that I had to leave everything behind and I wouldn't be able to fly, at least for the time being.
What's next for you, Mahadise? Do you plan on staying in Bulgaria?
I am planning to get back to Sky, no matter what. I'm going to work hard for it. And I have been working hard for it. I'm going to promise you, I'm going to get back to flying. Because if I stop flying, the people who look up on me, the girls who looked up on me and they thought that she can do such a thing, if they see me stop right here and think that's it for me, then what's the point of my existence? I want to go back to work. I want to fly again. And if it's in Bulgaria or any other country, doesn't matter.
Mahadise Mirzayi is Afghanistan's first female commercial airline pilot, speaking with us from exile in Bulgaria. Mahadise, thank you very much. We hope you can get back in the sky very soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Where there's a will, there's a way. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow with more stories from around the world.
From PRX.